It's time for triangulation and maybe the most important triangulation of the year, early in the year. My guest, Shoshana Zuboff, her book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. It is brilliant. Triangulation is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 380, recorded Friday, January 11th, 2019. The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology, and we get to spend an hour with them and really try to understand what they're all about. And this one is going to be a good one. I'm Leo Laporte. I thank you for being here. I pushed Megan and Jason aside so that I could do this because I've been anxious to do this ever since I heard about this work and our guest. I think you all probably remember, I know I do, in the mid-90s, the excitement we all felt about the internet. It was going to eliminate gatekeepers. It was going to give us all a voice. It was going to be the ultimate democratization of society. It was going to be friction-free commerce. We were all very excited. And then I also think, especially if you've been watching for a while or listening for a while, you've probably gone down this road with me. Something went wrong, whether it was the computer-generated videos aimed at our kids on YouTube, or the dumpster fire that is Twitter, or the continual breaches and apologies followed by more breaches at Facebook. Clearly, our hope for the future has been dimmed a little bit. Our guest today is Shoshana Zuboff. She is one of the first tenured professors at the Harvard Business School. She's currently the Charles Edward Wilson
Tenured professors.
There have been many before you. Shoshana, welcome. It's so great to have you. She's the Charles Edward Wilson Professor Emerita at the Harvard Business School. Has written a couple of books prior in The Age of the Smart Machine and The Support Economy. But this is going to be her magnum opus, I think. The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And I know there are some of, since Shoshana, you're talking to technologists here, people who are, you know, immersed in all of this. I know there's going to be some people saying, oh, we've heard it all before. No, it's inevitable. But I want to step back. We're going to talk about that. But I want to step back and first understand what surveillance capitalism is. You describe it in the book, and it's clear your background in business economics, sociology has been very helpful here. You describe the discovery of capitalism as the discovery of three commodities. Maybe we should start there to understand what capitalism is.
Great. Well, hello, Leo.
Hello. Welcome.
With you and our listeners and the odd viewer. Very, very pleased to be able to talk with you today.
They're very odd.
So, surveillance capitalism, in some ways, it radically breaks with the centuries-long traditions of capitalism. But in other ways, there are things that we can understand that connect it to the history of capitalism. So, for example, it's long been understood that capitalism evolves by taking things that are outside of the market, that live outside of the market. They do not have a price. They are not commodities. And finding ways to drag them into the market sphere so that they are able to be what we call commodified, bought and sold. So the great historian of the rise of the self-regulating market economy, Karl Polanyi, in the middle of the 20th century, he wrote a book called The Great Transformation, and he described what he called the three key fictional commodities that allowed industrial capitalism to root and flourish. The first was the idea that you could take human activity that lived outside the market and bring it into the market and call it labor, and you could price it. And that was the beginning of the ability to have a new structure of wage labor, hourly wage labor and salaried labor and so forth. So that was one of the first big inventions of industrial capitalism. The second was the idea of nature, that you could take the land and the trees and the lake that I'm looking out at and all of that, and you could bring it into the market and call it real estate or call it land, and you can buy it and sell it. And the third was the whole idea of exchange, which subordinated to the market now became money. So fast forward to the 21st century surveillance capitalism. Here was the big discovery that allowed surveillance capitalism to break through, to root and flourish. And that is the idea that you could take human experience, private human experience, you could drag it into the marketplace and call it behavioral data. And then with some application of value added here and computation there, you buy it, you sell it, you create whole new markets based on not just selling behavioral data, but selling the computational inferences and predictive analyses from behavioral data that allow interested business customers to lay bets on what we will do now, soon, and later. That's the essence of surveillance capitalism.
So we think of Henry Ford as an inventor of industrial capitalism. It goes back even earlier than that. Who came up with this surveillance capitalism? Where did it come from?
Well, great question. I write about the invention of surveillance capitalism at Google in the year 2001. And you're absolutely right, because the correct way to think about this is surveillance capitalism is something that was, you know, that fine line between being stumbled into and being invented, which is pretty much how the engineers at the Ford Motor Company felt about the, quote, discovery and invention of mass production. You know, there was actually a day that historians write about in the Ford Motor Company where, you know, at the end of the day, the engineers looked up from this work that they were doing, creating this moving assembly line, and they looked at each other, and there was a sense of recognition that they had just broken through to a new kind of economic logic of high volume, low unit cost. That was an economic logic that had not existed before. Similarly, at Google, we see a situation where in the teeth of financial crisis, in the dot-com bust, you know, Google had what most people agreed was the best search engine. They had the snazziest venture capitalists, you know, the most glamorous and the highest status venture capitalists who were investing in their dream. But here was the dot-com bust, and there was every reason to believe that Google was going to go down along with a lot of other small companies in Silicon Valley. And up until that time, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, they had been very vocal, very public about their abhorrence of advertising. They regarded advertising online as something that would deform the online environment and would separate online businesses from their users, which at that time were still conceivably something that you could think about as customers, users, customers. It wasn't really clear yet. So
they were collecting data. They were collecting data about how people used Google to improve the engine. At the time, the deal was, we'll collect the data to give you an improved product.
Yes, and things like improving search and also, you know, figuring out that great translation machine, because they would, you know, they would see how people spelled and how they corrected their spelling errors, and that would feed into the learning, the computer learning for translation and so forth. So at that point, there was what I think of as a balance of power between Google and its users.
See, I feel like I'm stuck in that I thought we were still there. And I've often said, well, you should know what data they're collecting and how they're using it. And then you can make a rational decision about whether you're getting enough value back for the data you're putting into the machine. But that turns out to be an antiquated concept, unfortunately.
Yeah, darling, we blew past that a long time ago.
Around about 2000 with the dot-com bust, right?
That's right.
The VCs went running, screaming to Google saying, but how are you going to make money?
Exactly. And there was a lot of terror and a lot of anxiety. And the people who documented that period, you know, are very, very eloquent about it. And what I like to say is that while these events have been well documented, they have been poorly understood and barely theorized.
Yeah.
So that's where I think we can make some progress. So what happened was we had this balance of power. You know, that's why these guys never wanted to charge users, because at that point, the company needed its users for this data to improve its services just about as much as the users needed the company. So there was this nice balance of power. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with collecting data if it's very clear and there is a clear social and legal contract that those data are being used for the benefit of the users in exactly the ways that they understand them to be. Demonstrably so. But something happened in this crisis. You know the concept of state of exception. A little bit of what we see going on in Washington today. You know, the state of exception is what is called upon to say, all right, we've got such an emergency going on here that we have to suspend our normal values and our normal rules and operating procedures. And we've got to do something really dire because it's an emergency. So essentially, the founders declared a state of exception. And in the state of exception, they decided to go back to this whole realm of advertising and see if they couldn't make a kind of breakthrough there. And parallel to this, you know, as people were browsing and searching and all of that, there was collateral data that was being thrown off by those activities that Google wasn't using. And in fact, they were only haphazardly stored, according to the documentation. They were called data logs, and they were in servers, but they weren't organized or stored. And there were some folks at Google who had been playing around with those data logs and slowly coming to the understanding that there was tremendous predictive value in those discarded data. Well, in the state of exception, folks went back to those data and they began to take a more careful look. So you take those data, which were exclusive to Google, and then you add to that Google's computational ability, which, by the way, even back then, they liked to talk about as, quote, artificial intelligence. So they were way ahead in their computational ability. So you take their computational power, their computational ability, their exclusive proprietary access to these formerly discarded data, you put that all together, and they discovered that they had the way to make very, very accurate predictions about the kinds of ads that a user is likely to click on. That became known as the click-through rate. And of course, that became the signal of the experience, the perceived relevance of an ad. So what Google did was, at that point, you still had a system where advertisers were choosing keywords and deciding where they would place their ads. Well, Google said, look, we are going to cut you completely out of that choice. We're going to let our new computational abilities and our new data that we're integrating here, we are going to make the choice for you based on these new skills. We are going to make the choice. We are going to tell you where to put the ad based on what these analyses tell us. And by telling you where to put that ad, we can now target your ad to the person and people who are most likely to click on it. Well, the rest is history, as everybody knows. But what is it exactly that happened here? That's what we've got to figure out. And my way of making sense of this is what happened here was We took data that was more than was required to make a great search engine or a great translation product and so forth. These extra data were surplus. They were just lying around. In fact, back then, people called them data exhaust and digital exhaust and things like that, like waste material. So who's going to be upset if, you know, if we take this waste material and start to use it? That's supposed to be a good thing, right? So we take the surplus behavioral data. Now we apply our unique computational capabilities to that. And what we are actually producing here are predictions. I call them prediction products. And what are they predictions of? Well, let's just zoom out a little bit, decouple from the idea of click-through. And what we're really saying is these are predictions of future behavior, predictions of what you are going to do, not only now, but soon and later. So we have behavioral surplus combined with new machine intelligence to create prediction products that predict the future of human behavior. New kinds of markets were configured. In the old world here, we talk about them as though they were simply markets for targeted advertising, targeted online advertising. But again, zoom out. And what becomes clear is that this new formula happened to be invented in the context of online targeted advertising, but it's no more limited to that context than, for example, mass production is limited to the fabrication of the Model T, where it was first invented.
That's the inflection point we're at right now. Up to now, and I think most people have kind of made peace with the idea that, well, we're getting targeted advertising based on our behavior. That makes Facebook and Google, in particular, the two chief practitioners of this, very rich and very powerful. But it's just advertising. What's the harm in that? You're talking about an inflection point where it becomes, you use the term instrumentarian power. Something a lot less benign. Is it happening now? Is it about to happen?
It's all around us. So you're absolutely right. And I forget exactly what word you use, but what you just conveyed was, you know, we slowly realized what they were doing and we kind of got used to it and we kind of accepted it, got normalized.
It's not exactly a Faustian bargain. It's just, you know, we're getting better ads. What's wrong with that?
Yes, what is wrong with that? And then I can, you know, close my laptop or shut my phone and walk away from it, and it's really no big deal.
Right.
So,
I mean, it works. I got off Instagram because I kept buying stuff in the middle of the night. It clearly works. And maybe I felt a little queasy that it worked so well. But as you said, I just took Instagram off the phone and all is well again.
Or is it? So now we're looking at a 20-year arc, right? We're just about two decades past this invention point, and a lot has happened in that 20 years. So we began with targeted advertising, habituating ourselves to that in just the way that you suggest. And of course, what the companies were learning was that, hey, the more behavioral surplus I can bring to this operation, the better my predictions. So now we're into economies of scale. So it's not just, what Leo is searching for, browsing for, how Leo is spelling. Now the idea to get scale is we've got to invent the methods that are going to follow Leo all over the web, and we're going to be taking behavioral data from Leo's actions, behavioral data from which we can create these predictive inferences, and we can figure out how to find that data and how to take those data, even if Leo has said he wants those data to be private. And even if Leo has refused to share those data, And even if Leo hasn't done anything online around these specific kinds of data, we can put together enough other data that Leo has put online that we can infer critical things that we want to infer about Leo.
Uh-oh.
So now we're moving beyond the simple ad targeting into a deeper set of methods that are actually saying, no matter what you have decided about this and what you have, you know, told this company or that about what data you're willing to share or how you want your data to be used, these methods are now designed to bypass, to go around those kinds of barriers and to literally rob you of those decision rights. Okay, maybe we can habituate to that too. Maybe we can get used to that too. So what's the next thing that happens? We've got these companies now competing over their predictions. And at first, it's largely Google and Facebook. This, of course, begins to spread through Silicon Valley. Eventually, it spreads to Microsoft. But more importantly, it becomes the default option for just about, you know, every startup and app that's coming out of Silicon Valley. So there's more competition for behavioral surplus, more competition for prediction products. So now it turns out, well, having a lot of the surplus isn't enough. We also need to have a variety of surplus. It's not enough to have scale. We also need scope. So what does scope mean? Scope means we got to get out of this laptop, off the desktop. We got to get out into the world. That's where, of course, mobility, the shift to mobility becomes critical. Because now the chief supply chain interface is going to be the phone and not the laptop or the desktop. But now we're out in the world. So what is the behavioral surplus that becomes most valuable? It's as people have slowly and painfully learned, you know, it's where you are, but it's also what you're doing. And then it's what you're doing it with. And then as we ratchet forward over the years with economies of scope, we see economies of scope actually operate in two dimensions. One is we've got to have, you know, extend out from the person as far as possible. So everywhere you're going and where you're running and what you're eating and all of that stuff, if you're going into a restaurant or a shop, but also depth, not only extension, but depth. So we want to know how you're feeling. What are your emotions? We want to know what your face looks like. Is it tense? Are you happy? Are you sad? We want to know about your what has become known as your affective states. And this is how affective computing, which some people will have heard of, which began as a kind of, you know, nice capability where the computer could learn some things about your emotions and maybe like help you get through a job interview or help teachers better support an autistic child. This was immediately colonized by all kinds of businesses and ad agencies and so forth who want to know what you're feeling. So now affective computing is a very big growth industry in which people are using cameras and facial recognition and voice recognition in order to make assessments about how you're feeling. And that becomes very predictive behavioral surplus. Okay, so now we're way beyond targeted ads where we're delving into sort of every aspect of your experience and your behavior. Now it turns out that there's a third big discovery, and that is it's not just scale and it's not just scope. The most predictive behavioral surplus comes from actually intervening in your experience, intervening in your activities, and doing subtle things that will shape and nudge and tune and herd you in specific directions that lead you toward the kind of commercial outcomes that surveillance capitalism's business customers are paying for. So this is what I call...
Let me pause for just a second, because we are now...
Yes, please.
That, I think everybody watching knows and is participating in that, but that last might be a step too far. I mean, I'm sitting here with my smartphone, my ring that's sensing all my movements, my heart rate, my sleep patterns. I've spit into a tube. They've got my genetic information. Everything is now in the databases. So the next question is, what are we going to do with that? Our guest is Shoshana Zuboff, Professor Emerita at the Harvard Business School. The book is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And it isn't quite out yet as we do this interview. It'll be out in four days. Yeah. So rush, pre-order it on Amazon. Will there be an audio version of this as well?
Yes.
I'm looking forward to that because it is well over 500 pages. And while I have...
525, Leo.
It's exactly 525 pages. That doesn't include copious footnotes, which I really appreciated. It is a work of academic rigor, but it is also, Chris Hoffnagel calls it the information industry's silent spring. I might say it is Das Kapital for the 21st century. It really is an examination of what is absolute. I mean, no one can deny this is happening, and what its impact will be. And that's where I want to go next. By the way, one of the reasons to buy the book is to highlight every seminal. It is practically yellow now. I mean, I have really, but it's a great read. It's very engaging. You fill it with anecdotes, which I really appreciate, and you do that, I know, consciously. And so it makes it very accessible. As academically rigorous it is, it's very accessible. In fact, boy, Robert Reich says it's brilliant and essential. Andrew Keen has been on this show a couple of times, says a book of immense ambition and erudition. Doc Searles, who we love, my mind is blown on every page by the depth of Shoshana Zuboff's research, the breadth of her knowledge, the rigor of her intellect, and finally the power of her arguments. It's the most important book of our time, he says, the author of the Clue Train Manifesto. Doc, like me, back in Clue Train days, we were very optimistic, but now we do see a darker, I think we all see a darker side to this. You said something that's really scary. They go from predicting to influencing. Tell me about that mechanism. Is that happening now?
Well, the reason I wanted to, you know, move through those stages to explain this to our listeners is because once you understand these new economies of action, then the conversation that I have in the book about surveillance capitalism as producing a new quality of power, I call it a new species of power. If I don't explain these underlying mechanisms, you might think, oh boy, you know, Zuboff's writing science fiction. But once you understand these new mechanisms, it's like, oh man, this is already happening. This is all around us.
Yeah,
this is not science fiction.
Our audience is immersed in this. We know this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, being immersed, we're all immersed in it, and that's part of the problem, because when you're immersed in something, it's really hard to notice it.
Yeah.
So part of the service that I've tried to provide is to, you know, not be immersed in it and come around the outside and look at it from a different perspective so that I can name it in a way that has been a bit difficult. So when it comes to this idea of, okay, if we can actually intervene in your behavior and shape your behavior, wow, that's really predictive. Because the whole idea now is for the predictions to approximate observation. You with me?
Yep.
So who needs predictions if we actually know exactly what you're going to do? Because we made you do it.
Yeah.
Right? So,
but what are the kinds of things? I mean, is it staying in the world of commerce? We're going to make you buy Tide Pods? Or is it something a little darker?
Yeah, well, We've been guinea pigs in the early mass experiments in economies of action. So, you know, you go back to 2012, 13, 14. One of the things that was making big headlines long before we heard of Cambridge Analytica was Facebook's contagion experiments. You remember that?
Tell me. The name rings a bell, but I don't remember what they were doing. You mentioned this in the book. What were they doing?
Yeah. So in the first one, this was around the 2012 midterm elections. And what they were doing was experimenting, obviously, in ways that were carefully designed not to trigger your awareness. So robbing you of the ability to know what they're doing and to opt into an experiment, therefore, which is, of course, violates every tenet of modern human experimentation. But so what they were doing was subtly changing your news feed and subtly planting what we call like subliminal cues on the pages that you saw that would nudge you toward voting. For example, they might have messages from your friends coupled with an I voted button. Mm-hmm. And other, you know, very specific kinds of little design tweaks that were aiming at subliminally appealing to these social comparison processes, which is the primary dynamic in social media. You know, I'm me, you're you. Am I better than you? Are you better than me? You know, how do we compare to each other? As all the research shows, these social comparison processes are really the sort of core of what's going on. And it's through those social comparisons that we can persuade people and nudge people to do certain kinds of things. So if I'm comparing myself to you and I think that you're really cool, Leo, and I want to be as cool as you are, and I find out that you voted, then I want to vote too.
So well, this is a good thing. Gets everybody to vote, right?
Yeah, well, until we get to Cambridge Analytica, we discover that not only can we use these exact same methods to get you to vote, but to decide who you're going to vote for, right? And so now we're shifting from, you know, we're usurping your decision rights. We're usurping your rights to self-determination because we're bypassing, by design, bypassing your awareness, not giving you a say in whether or not you participate. But now we're also bypassing your ability to be a critical thinker and a morally autonomous thinker, which is the essential individual condition for a functioning democracy. And so we take these same methods that Facebook used in its contagion experiments, which, by the way, it published the results of these experiments in a scholarly journal, literally, you know, crowing with tremendous pride. We've discovered that the online environment is an environment where hidden contagion can be effective. These hidden cues that produce contagion can be effective. This was considered a great achievement. And while everybody around the world was up in arms about this, and people were saying, you know, Facebook can throw an election. Facebook can, you know, can make us vote for people. This is simply not okay. While that debate was going on, the Facebook folks were already involved in a second large scale, they call it, you know, massive scale contagion experiment on emotions. Maybe you remember that one.
That came out
the following year. And the idea was, again, these subtle cues planted in your newsfeed and on your pages that were designed to either make you feel happier or sadder, you know, better or worse.
I remember and also again, that a lot of the critiques of this were more that they were doing it without your consent than looking ahead to what the implications
were.
And furthermore, this is a big change because now the customer for this data has changed. It's not Procter & Gamble alone anymore. Now it's governments. Now it's people that haven't been in this system before. And that is a big shift. Where the money's coming from? Who's using it?
It's literally anyone who has the money to pay to play in these behavioral futures markets. Right. So you think of these predictions as a kind of behavioral derivative. And now we have futures markets in behavior, and we can have futures markets in political behavior and futures markets in commercial behavior. And, you know, these futures markets depend upon the hidden, indecipherable, undetectable manipulation and modification of our behavior of individuals, of groups, of populations. So again, do the zoom out with me, everybody. When we zoom out from here, what do we find? We find that all of this whole apparatus, which was originally about targeted advertising, and as you said, Leo, you know, a lot of us decided, okay, well, you know, live and let live. We can deal with this. Now what we have is those, the pieces of that are assembled. More pieces are added, more behavioral surplus from intervening in our behavior. And what we have created is what I call a means of behavioral modification. You know that in the 20th century, we talked about the means of production. But now the means of production, which in our case here is machine intelligence, now the means of production are actually subordinated to this much larger set of methods and methodologies, which is a means of behavioral modification. And that's what surveillance capitalism is elaborating. If you can use a means of behavioral modification that depends upon a world-class cornering of data science skills, which we know the surveillance capitalists have already done, you can make so much more money as a data scientist, as a machine intelligence specialist, working for the surveillance capitalists than teaching at a university. So we have a brain drain issue where this level of talent now is agglomerating in these surveillance capitalist firms. So we've got a means of behavioral modification that depends upon cornering this special class of global talent, which depends upon leveraging the most powerful machine learning capabilities that exist anywhere on planet Earth. And at the same time, all of that supported by some of the largest market capitalizations that have ever been known in the history of markets. So now we have what? We have very rich companies with exclusive access to the skills, exclusive access to the actual technological means, and they're using that to know more than we can ever know. And when it comes to these information asymmetries, you got to ask the question, well, what gives you the right? You know, who decides that you're allowed to know all this stuff? Well, right now, the only people who are deciding that are the surveillance capitalists themselves. So they've got the knowledge and they've usurped the authority to say it's our right to get this knowledge and to use this knowledge. And then you say, well, if you've got that authority, like, who decides that you get to have that authority? Who decides that you decide that you can know all of this? Well, the surveillance capitalism folks themselves are deciding that they can decide that they can know all of this, if you follow my train. So we've got who knows, who decides, who decides, who decides. Knowledge, authority, and power, they've got it all.
They and decide because you liken it to Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. It's opaque how it's working, what it's doing. It's opaque. And Google's not evil. That's their motto. Is they're not evil. Who are this? You say it's not Big Brother anymore. It's Big Other. Who are these people? It's Google. It's Facebook. Who else?
Well, you know.
And are they evil? Are they bad men?
This has nothing to do with evil, and this has at this point has very little to do with individuals. This has to do with economic imperatives.
It's a force.
So what have we got here? We started at Google. Sheryl Sandberg left Google and took it to Facebook. So then we had Google and Facebook. Then it began to spread throughout Silicon Valley. everybody could see the enormous wealth being created by these methods and methodologies. So now we're into Silicon Valley. Microsoft, once Nadella takes over at Microsoft, the whole logic is migrating to Microsoft. Now we see it migrating to Amazon as well. A lot of hope still hangs on Apple, and that's a whole other conversation in itself. But the thing is, Leo, that that we can no longer think about surveillance capitalism as something that's about the tech sector or about internet businesses or about Silicon Valley. Now, these same methods and methodologies, behavioral underwriting, in the insurance industry, we see it in retail, entertainment, health, finance, transportation. This, you know, look at what's happening even in the past few weeks, the news coming out of Ford Motor Company, which I bring up as an example because it brings us full circle to the beginning of the 20th century in mass production. So now Ford Motor Company sees automobiles in a global slump. And it was just a couple of weeks ago, right around Christmas, that the CEO of Ford said, hey, you know, the new business for Ford could really be data. Because really our cars, we're going to reevaluate our cars and think of them as data gathering devices. And we've got all these people sitting in our cars who trust Ford Motor, and they're going here and there, and they're talking on their phone. Just think of all the data that we can get from these vehicles. What would it be like if we monetize those data, right? So now this thing has spread across the economy, no longer about Silicon Valley. This has gone from being a Silicon Valley invention in a state of emergency to a new surveillance-based economic order. And so when we talk about these capabilities, and typically you'll hear folks talk about, oh boy, you know, Google has become Big Brother. A lot of people write about this as a kind of digital totalitarianism. But the argument that I'm making is a different one. What I have just described to you has never existed before. You remember I said that mass production was an economic logic that never existed before? Mm-hmm. What I have just described to you, surveillance capitalism, claiming our experience without our even knowing about it, unilaterally taking our experience, turning it into data, prediction products, not only knowing everything about us, but shaping our behavior, selling our future bets on our behavior, this has never existed before. It's unprecedented. And the problem is that when we encounter something unprecedented, what our minds do is ratchet back to things that are familiar. And we try to interpret the unprecedented in terms of things that we already have some familiarity with, because it allows us, you know, not to be overwhelmed by anxiety. Even with the automobile, you know, people talked about the horseless carriage, which was a way of taking old categories, horses, carriages, and then, you know, putting that on top of this newfangled automobile thing, which was going to transform the world. But we literally could not get our minds around it. So right now, what I want our listeners to understand is that we are not up against totalitarianism. We are not up against Big Brother. If we were, we would know it. Totalitarianism was a form of power that tried to control societies through terror and succeeded. Through terror, through murder, through mass murder. Totalitarianism was about bearing down on your body, inflicting pain until you were willing to give up your soul. We're in a different kind of world now, Leo. I call it the distinction between totalitarian power and what I call instrumentarian power, because it's a new kind of power that uses these distant instruments of digitalization, ubiquitous digitalization, you know, from all the stuff that you're putting in your kitchen, that digital assistant that maybe you have sitting somewhere on the kitchen table, your phone, obviously all your online interactions, but now maybe your television set, Leo, maybe your sleeping, your sleep apnea apparatus, which it turns out is secretly siphoning off behavioral surplus to health companies and other kinds of folks who are interested in how you're sleeping. Some interesting analysis was done of a single Nest thermostat, where these legal scholars concluded that if you put one Nest thermostat in your home, you basically should be reviewing at least 1,000 privacy policies.
Because of the third parties that data is going out to. And
the infinite so regress.
Yeah. But we get benefit from so many of those things. You know, the argument my friend Jeff Jarvis uses is, well, but yeah, think of the benefit to humanity all of this big data is going to offer in terms of medical treatments and so forth. We get benefit out of it. Is that a devil's bargain, though?
Well, here's the thing. Whose benefit? Benefit according to whom? Who decides?
Well, let's
who decides
okay,
what
who decides
a benefit
is another is. Question. Yeah, but let's okay. say and this was a big story when 23andMe said we're going to sell a third of our company to Glaxo, and they're going to use that information to develop better drugs. That sounds like a benefit. It's anonymized. It's not information about me, even though they have my spit. Isn't that a benefit to society?
Well, whether or not big data is a benefit to society has nothing to do with the technology we're talking about. Whether or not big data is a benefit depends upon the economic logic that imbues the technology and commands it. So if we're talking about surveillance capitalism as the dominant economic logic, then the benefits from big data are largely going to accrue to surveillance capitalism's customers. So, for example, you know, we talk about the smart city. Google likes to talk about the Google city. Now, of course, there's going to be a huge amount of data in such cities, and we can imagine all kinds of benefits, but if the data is Google data, and if Google decides that it can know, and Google decides that it has the authority to decide, you know, what the benefits are, then the long game here is a situation where not only individuals but whole populations, like the populations of cities, are shaped and tuned and herded to move in certain patterns, to go in certain directions, which, by the way, benefit the surveillance capitalist business customers. Right. There may be benefits to society, but we have no way of assessing the balance between and the cost benefit between the benefits to society. For example, in the city, you know, maybe we can do a lot better job with traffic. We can do a lot better job with emissions and the quality of air and a variety of things like that. But at the same time, in order to do that, what have we accomplished? We've usurped individual decision rights. We've changed the logic of individual autonomy. We've given a private commercial operation the authority to decide what is a benefit and to herd populations toward those already a priori, you know, outcomes, the outcomes that these business customers have decided are beneficial. And we've fundamentally shifted functions that should be public functions, that should be democratic functions, where folks get together in the place they live and they decide how they want it to be and the means that they want to use to create those changes and reach those goals. These are public, participatory, community, and democratic decisions. And we've ceded those decisions to machines that are owned and operated by private capital, specifically private surveillance capital. So this is taking us into a territory, Leo, that is completely uncharted.
Yeah.
And when you read what the folks who are proselytizing these changes, what they write about, including many of the tech leaders themselves, they're writing about a world that is actually post-democracy and post-politics. Because now, you know, you put all the data in the machine spits out the answer. We don't need politics.
Yeah.
We don't need to vote. We don't need democracy.
It's like the lion in the zoo saying, well, at least I get three square meals a day. It's we're talking to Shoshana Zuboff. Professor Zuboff is a professor emeritus. Emerita at Harvard Business School, the author of a number of books. Her new book, perhaps the most important book you'll read this year, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the Frontier of Power, comes out on Tuesday from Public Affairs Books. The people that this is going to be impacting are our kids.
Our kids.
What do you tell them? Is it hopeless?
Oh, gosh, no. No. We've been talking about some pretty heavy stuff, for sure. But one thing I want our listeners to know is that surveillance capitalism is a man-made phenomenon. Man-made. That's something. That's a quote from Steinbeck. But the point is that surveillance capitalism is something that folks figured out, concocted, elaborated. It was so financially successful that it was able to spread. Early on, we thought it was something, you know, that we could live with, and so we didn't really muster our resistance. But the fact is that we're talking about capitalism here, folks. We're not talking about something that is inevitable to digital technology. You know, You ratchet back to the year before surveillance capitalism was invented, the year 2000. That year, if you go back and you look at what people were writing about the smart home and what people were writing about telemedicine, just as much enthusiasm about those ideas as there is now. But back then, the assumptions were, if you have a smart home, all the data go to the person who lives in that house. Exclusively, a single closed loop. And whoever lives in the house decides how they're going to use the data, what it means, and so forth, if they're going to share it or not. Same with telemedicine. You have these engineering designs of telemedicine, the year 2000, and you see a closed loop that includes a patient in her home, the doctor, and a server that's in the local hospital. A closed loop. The only people who get the data are the doctor and the patient. Well, a year later, with the discovery and early implementation of surveillance capitalism, you know, that whole image just began to evaporate. And now we have, you know, what we mentioned a minute ago, you know, you got the smart home with thousands and thousands of third parties who may or may not, you know, have pieces of your speech, have pieces of your sleep, have pieces of your face, your behavior, the map of your living room, you know, taken from your vacuum cleaner. So this has nothing to do with the technology. This is a thing that people figured out and people implemented. It has been protected by capital. It has been protected by some very favorable historical conditions that I write about. It's also been protected by the fact that it was designed to keep us ignorant. So we didn't know what was going on and we really didn't, you know, get our outrage going. And it's been protected by the fact that it didn't take very long before everything that we need to do now to participate in our societies actually takes us right through the heart of surveillance capitalism's supply chains. So these two things have been conflated, what I need to do to participate on a daily basis and what they need to get their behavioral surplus from my experience. So we've got this sort of dependency. what I hear young people talking about is the idea that there is no place to hide, that there is no escape, that there is no longer a backstage where I can go, you know, to gather my wits, to take a deep breath, to feel that sense of inwardness, of reflection, that I am completely alone in a world that I control. And that inwardness, you know, there's a very pernicious line that's out there, which I've heard some of the tech titans repeat, and that is, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about. Well, the real truth is, if you've got nothing to hide, you are nothing. Because everything that we are as a self comes from this inwardness, our ability to reflect, to think, to feel, to, you know, to curl up on the sofa, to have our reflective time. This inwardness and self-reflection, that's where we develop our sense of will and our sense of freedom, our sense of autonomy. These things are essential not only to modern individuals, but to the very prospect of a democratic society. So when I hear young people talking about these things, you know, my sense of emergency, let's say, is really triggered. And what I tell young people is, look, what you're feeling now, the idea that you have to hide, that if you're walking across campus, you have to think about how you're behaving and how you look, because somebody might have their phone on and be broadcasting you on the internet. Right, this idea of the double chilling effect, not only a chilling effect what you do online, but a chilling effect now in the real world, anticipating these unknown and unseen but potential internet audiences that you have no control over. So we've got our young people living in this world dominated by social comparison processes, which produce tremendous anxiety and are real burdens on the mental health, especially of young people who are still forming their identities. We have them in a situation where there is no exit. You know, the great social psychologist Stanley Milgram, some of our listeners may have heard of the Milgram experiment, mm-hmm. You know, where they gave the artificial shocks to people and tried to see if the people asked to administer those shocks would refuse to do so. Anyway, he's a brilliant social psychologist. He wrote very poignantly about the idea that there is no way for an individual to maintain themselves with equilibrium and develop their own personality, their own character, their own identity, if there isn't some way for them to exit from the gaze of others and really have that kind of autonomous environment where they can commune with themselves. And of course, the great sociologist Irving Goffman took up those themes. I bet a lot of people have heard of this idea of, you know, the social presentation of self, the idea that, yeah, we're on stage and we present ourselves in certain ways, just like I did right now. You know, I put on my lipstick, I got my nice blouse on. But we can only function well on stage because we have a backstage.
Yeah.
And you see this, you know, if anybody has ever participated in the theater or been in a concert, you know, a musician in a concert, I mean, or even just teaching in a classroom, you know, or what I'm doing now on stage, I can bring you all my energy because when we sign off, Leo, you know, I'm going to go in the kitchen. I'm going to sit down with my daughter, have a cup of tea. I'm going to, you know, kick my shoes off and get back to work. And I've got my backstage time. That's what replenishes me and makes me Shoshana Zuboff.
Yeah.
So this is what we're bringing up our children robbed of these essential qualities of human experience that are essential to the development of freedom and autonomy. And so more than anything else, Leo, and my kids are both in their 20s, more than anything else, it's our children, our young people that I want to address with this book. And that's one reason why I put so much of myself into the book. You know, I told a lot of personal stories in the book. I use my own experience because it's time that we got away from talking about this as something of just about technology or just about economics and talking about how it lives in and through our bodies and changes the prospect of our lives, which means the prospect of our future, of our society and our democracy.
I think a lot of people when, and I know a lot of people when they see this and hear the idea, they say, oh, it's another screed against technology. But you're not against technology at all.
No, not at all. And we all have great hopes for digital technology. And surveillance capitalism is now in the way. But we can get that out of the way. And the reason I know we can get that out of the way is that we've done it before. So if you think back to the late 19th, early 20th century, you know, the Gilded Age had a beginning, a middle, and an end. How did it end? It ended because enough people said, this is not okay. And public opinion shifted, and we developed political power, and we used the resources of our democratic institutions, and we pressured our elected officials. And ultimately, there were the laws and the regulatory institutions that made it impossible to employ child labor, for example, or impossible to force people to work 70 hours a week and so forth. Safe working conditions, safe products.
Oh, but so, Professor Zuboff, aren't you falling for that precedence problem? Because this isn't like industrial capitalism. The things that saved us from industrial capitalism may not be adequate to save us from surveillance capitalism.
Well, as long as we live in a democratic society, it's democracy that has to save us.
Okay.
So it's not the same solutions, Leo. It's not like we have to, you know, have a new regime of child labor laws.
Yeah, or break up Google.
Or necessarily break up Google. I mean, one of the things I talk about is the idea that where the analogy exists is that our societies, and I mean certainly, you know, the United States, Western Europe, we have already learned in the 20th century how to use democracy to confront the destructive excesses of a raw capitalism. We did that in the Gilded Age. We did that in the Depression. We did that in the post-war years. And we did that successfully until really the 1980s, the end of the 20th century, when neoliberalism became the dominant paradigm and the state was forced to back off of its regulatory responsibilities. So we're now at a point where a lot of people are fed up with that, and we may actually be at the end or nearing the end of that arc of the neoliberal paradigm. And there are many, many people in our societies who want to reinvigorate democracy. And I know that as we're facing authoritarian threats around the world, and we're facing actually authoritarian threats in our own country. And right now, it doesn't feel like democracy is working that well as we have minority rule. But you know, in the end, at least so far, our democratic institutions are holding. And I personally, speaking for myself, I'm persuaded that they will hold and that, you know, we've been through bad times before. We'll get through this one, too. And, you know, we're not talking about a 5-point action plan, you know, that you're supposed to produce at the end of a business case. We're talking about deep movements in history. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a decade, maybe two decades, maybe three decades, as we gather our forces, public opinion shifts, we require our elected officials to take action, we understand how these new operations of surveillance capitalism work, and we design the 21st century version of regulatory institutions, the 21st century version of necessary legislation that will interrupt and outlaw these pernicious dynamics. For example, you hear a lot of people saying, well, we've got to break up these companies. Well, from a strictly capitalist point of view, there may be good reason to break up some of these companies. But breaking up those companies is not going to fix the problems that we've just been talking about for the last hour or so, the problems of surveillance capitalism.
It's just going to metastasize it. It's not going to get rid of it.
It's going to metastasize it. Thank you, Leo. Yeah. You break up Google or Facebook, and then we have, you know, four little surveillance capitalists instead of one big surveillance capitalist. And then we've created a new dynamic competitive territory for more surveillance capitalists to enter. So we have to understand what are the actual, operational points and mechanisms where a new legislative effort would have to address. For example, people talk about data ownership as if that's going to solve a problem. Well, talking about data ownership is like going back to the analogy of child labor. That's like negotiating that a seven-year-old can only work 4 hours a day. Right. So, yeah, we have child labor, but not too much.
Not so bad.
So if we're talking about data ownership, Leo, we're talking about a situation where these data, which are fundamentally illegitimate, taken from us outside of our awareness in order to do things about us that are not aligned with our interests. So these are data that are illegitimate and should not exist. And if they are going to exist, then it's our decision, and how they are used and who sees them and so forth and so on is our decision, with accountability, with checks and balances, with transparency. So data ownership, all that does is, essentially legitimate and institutionalize these extraction operations, which are fundamentally illegitimate in the first place. So this is why the naming, understanding how this works, but these are things that are invented by people, and they will be conquered by people. They can be interrupted and outlawed by people. They were invented in the social. They were invented in history. That's where we confront them. We resist them. And ultimately, we overturn them. We make them not only socially unacceptable, but also illegal. We've done it before successfully, and we can do it again. Because what's at stake now? What's at stake is the 21st century, Leo.
Yeah.
The kind of civilization that we're going to live in the 21st century, whether or not the digital is ours or theirs.
You can already see them planning for it with universal basic income and, smart cities, as you point out. I mean, you can, Larry Page saying, I wish we just could be on an island with no regulation. We could do it right then.
Universal basic income and smart cities. This is, you mentioned Marx before, but I can't help but resurrect the idea, the opiate of the masses. You know, if folks maybe just have enough, they won't care about freedom.
Right.
They won't care about democracy. They won't care about personal self-determination. They won't care about inwardness. I don't think that is consistent with the human story. Maybe that can have its day, have its moment here or there for a little while. But that is not consistent for the human story. Zoom way back, everybody. Zoom way back. And what you see is millennia in which human beings have fought and sacrificed their lives, their blood, their futures for the sake of these ideals of freedom, of self, of individual autonomy, the things that our founders put in our Declaration of Independence and our Bill of Rights, the Enlightenment ideals, which, some people think they're passé, but I think they're brand new. In the larger human story, they are brand new. They are 5 minutes old. Mm-hmm. And everything that we can do to fight and defend and protect these hard-won capabilities of our group, that's essential.
And it starts with understanding what's going on.
It starts with understanding.
That's what this book does so masterfully. Really an eye-opener. The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. I think anybody who watches our shows will recognize immediately the situation we're in. There's no denying it, but it's important to kind of understand the ultimate consequences of it so that we can fight for our own sovereignty effectively.
Well said, Leo.
Yeah. Professor Zuboff, it is an honor and a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
The sun has come out in Maine. The lake is going to be beautiful. I hope you have loons.
many loons that we love with all our heart.
Oh, yeah. They're awesome. I thank you so much for giving us an hour of your precious time and many years in this book. It's a must read. Thank you, Professor Zuboff.
Thank you so much, Leo.
My pleasure. We do triangulation. Now our new time is Fridays, 11:30 a.m. Pacific. That's 2:30 Eastern. And if you want to watch anywhere in the world, that would be 18:30 UTC. Please do tune in at twit.tv/live. If you watch live, join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You're the third side of the triangle in triangulation. We really appreciate your feedback there. Of course, all of our shows are available on demand, in this case at twit.tv/TRI. I know some of you are listening in airplanes right now. Please, when you land, go to twit.tv/TRI because we have many hundreds of very interesting interviews like this one. In fact, maybe the best thing to do would be subscribe. Use your favorite podcast application and subscribe to Triangulation. That way, each week, the minute it's available, you'll get a fresh episode for you to listen to at your leisure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.